The 57th quadrennial U.S. presidential election is November 6th. In the final week of the campaign, the two frontrunners, Democrat Barack Obama and Republican Mitt Romney, are running neck and neck in the polls. Are there substantive policy differences between the main contenders? What is at stake in this election for Americans and the world? What are some of the key issues that have been overlooked by the media in this campaign? And what do American citizens need to reflect on before they cast their ballots on Tuesday? As the campaign nears the finish line, we will discuss the election with three political observers and contributors to the Center for Research on Globalization: activist and journalist Rick Rozoff, professor and writer Peter Phillips, and journalist and researcher Julie Levesque. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 1st, 2012. I'm program host Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. We'll begin our show with some of the major news stories shaping the national and international political landscape. At least 46 people are dead and millions without power following the devastation wrought by Hurricane Sandy as it touched down on the northeast seaboard of the United States Monday night at 6:45 p.m. and steamed inland Tuesday. The superstorm generated a surge of water up to 13 feet high, flooding lower Manhattan and submerging streets and parks throughout Brooklyn. New York City Mayor Bloomberg stated, quote, "This was a devastating storm, maybe the worst that we have ever experienced," unquote. By late Tuesday, the storm damage stretched across 20 states from New England to Tennessee. The New York region's airports were closed Tuesday, forcing the cancellation of 18,000 flights. Amtrak canceled all of its Northeast Corridor rail service Tuesday. Four towns in New Jersey were flooded under 6 feet of water. Major stock exchanges were closed Tuesday for a second day. In the Canadian provinces of Quebec and Ontario, 90,000 people were reported to be without power. President Barack Obama declared Tennessee, New York City, and New Jersey to be disaster areas and pledged to assist local authorities cope with the damage. And that comes to you from NBC News. Hurricane Sandy forced half a dozen nuclear power plants to slow or shut down, while Exelon Corporation's Oyster Creek plant in New Jersey declared a rare alert status for only the third time this year, due to rising floodwaters. The second lowest of four emergency action levels was triggered when water levels at the nation's oldest nuclear power plant rose 6.5 feet, potentially affecting the water intake mechanism that pumps water through the plant. While the reactor had been shut down for planned refueling since October 22nd, the concern was that the motor, which pumped cooling water to the spent fuel rods, might be submerged and fail, causing the rods to overheat. In an extreme scenario, the uranium rods could overheat and cause the release of radiation. According to a Nuclear Regulatory Commission spokesperson, however, the pumps did not flood and a portable pump was brought in as a precaution. A representative of the Federal Emergency Management Agency stated on the Today Show, quote, "Right now, there's no imminent threat of releases. There's no protective actions around the plant." And that comes from Reuters. The U.S. is joining its voice to that of France as it lobbies Algeria to support an emergency military intervention in northern Mali, where Al-Qaeda-linked militants are waging a terror campaign. Several U.S. cabinet ministers are devoted to planning an intervention force. Algeria's support would be crucial for confronting the militants and pushing them out of Mali and back across its borders. The group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is believed to be responsible for the attack on U.S. diplomats last month in Benghazi, Libya. Their leaders are based in northern Mali, where they took over territory following a military coup which shattered the government last spring. The French President François Hollande is expected to visit Algeria next month with the goal of finalizing regional support of the International Intervention Force, which would be dispatched early next year. And that story comes from the Washington Post. Israel is accusing Sudan of channeling Iranian arms to militant groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. The accusation came one day after a weapons factory near Khartoum was bombed in an airstrike Wednesday, the 24th. Sudan, in turn, suspects Israel was behind the airstrike, noting the sophistication of the technology used. Israel remains concerned about Iran, citing what they call Iranian calls for Israel's destruction, concerns about Iran developing a nuclear weapon, and Iran's support for militant groups on their southern and northern border. Sudan has been engaged in conflicts over the last several years, both with the western region of Darfur and with the newly formed South Sudan. It was also a major hub for al-Qaeda militants and a transit route for weapons smugglers and migrant traffickers. The actual perpetrator of the airstrike on the 24th is unknown, but Jonah Leff, who monitors Sudan for the Geneva-based Small Arms Survey, feels Israel is the most likely culprit. And that story comes from the Associated Press. The UN's Human Rights Council has urged the boycott of 13 companies which derive profit from Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. In a statement to the UN General Assembly, HRC's Special Rapporteur, Richard Falk, stated, quote, "Businesses should not breach international humanitarian law provisions. Companies Caterpillar Incorporated, Veolia Environment, G4SM, the Dexia Group, Ahava, the Volvo Group, Rival Holding Group, Elbit Systems, Hewlett-Packard, Mehadrin, Motorola, Asa Abloy, and Cemex have, in Falk's view, violated human rights through their linked businesses with the settlements." In his report, Falk stated that Israeli settlements have control over 40% of the West Bank and that 600,000 Israeli citizens had already transferred in Palestinian territories. According to Falk, the settlements-linked businesses may have been set up in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention relating to the rights of civilians in war zone areas. As the point man for Palestinian human rights, Falk is calling for the businesses in question to attend to their obligations under international human rights and humanitarian law, or be reprimanded. And that story comes from albawaba.com. Voters in Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Texas, and Wisconsin are being told they require photo ID to be eligible to vote in the November elections, even though there are no such legal restrictions in place. In Texas, a columnist for the Dallas Morning News attempted to vote using his utility bill, considered acceptable ID under the law. The poll worker had demanded he show her his driver's license. In Pennsylvania, there are misleading ads about requiring photo ID, even though they don't. And in Wisconsin, the Romney campaign is likewise distributing misleading information to poll watchers about who is eligible to vote. Republicans in all four states have tried to get such laws instituted, only to be blocked by the courts on the grounds that it would hurt turnout for minority voters and that it would impose, quote, strict, unforgiving burdens on the poor who cannot afford the fees charged for obtaining photo ID. Many Democrats are concerned that their base, who is disproportionately affected by these moves, may be discouraged by the confusion from casting a ballot. That story comes from the Huffington Post. On Monday, October 29th, a federal judge ruled that it was reasonable for the Drug Enforcement Administration to set up multiple covert digital surveillance cameras on rural property without a warrant and without permission in the name of uncovering evidence of 30 to 40 marijuana plants being grown there. U.S. District Judge William Griesbach based his ruling on an October 9th recommendation by U.S. Magistrate Judge William Callahan, arguing that DEA surveillance does not violate the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution relating to unreasonable searches and the procurement of warrants. Callahan wrote, quote, "The Supreme Court has upheld the use of technology as a substitute for ordinary police surveillance," unquote. With digital sensors and wireless technology becoming more powerful, the Justice Department's argument implies that police can now install surveillance cameras on private property without permission or court oversight. And that comes from CNET.
As we record this interview, we're in the final stretch of the elections. Presidential election day is November 6th. In which the people of the United States get a chance to express their views as to who should be the next president of the United States. We are seeing from polling that it's a dead heat. But how has this campaign been so far, especially as it relates to the recent debate on foreign policy? Rick Rozoff is joining us. He is an activist who manages the organization Stop NATO International, an investigative journalist, and a man with a background in running presidential election campaigns. So, Rick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I do have to correct you slightly, though. You've inflated my credentials with the best of intentions, but I've worked on presidential campaigns, but in fact have not managed them. Though have managed other campaigns on a state level, municipal level. And, you know, as a result, I can tell your listeners that far from Americans having, you know, the opportunity of choosing somebody to lead their country, they're simply given the, you know, dubious choice or the Hobson's choice of voting for one of two candidates, Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, who have been, you know, selected by the party bosses of the two, you know, major respective political parties that have a monopoly on the election process in the United States. And, of course, standing behind them are the ones who have contributed what is now an estimated $2.5 billion to the coffers of those two candidates. So we Americans have precious little opportunity of selecting anyone to represent us.
Okay. So if you're basically detecting then, you know, based on what you've seen in the campaign so far, that's a choice between two candidates where there doesn't seem to be a lot of difference in terms of policy.
That's correct. On the domestic front, you know, precious little except for, you know, appealing to certain core constituency groups on single issues, and your listeners, I'm sure, know what they are. They tend to be, you know, depending on where one stands on, you know, the political spectrum in the United States, everything from abortion to gun control to school prayer and such like. But when it comes to substantive socioeconomic matters at home and certainly foreign policy issues abroad, there is precious little to differentiate the two candidates and the parties they represent. You know, that's first of all. And, you know, secondly, just today, the head of Russia's Central Election Commission referred to the U.S. political system, particularly the presidential election process, as being, I believe I'm quoting, one of the least democratic in the world, and that's certainly the case.
Now, could you maybe elaborate on your previous comments? Exactly what is it that drives policy in the United States, if not the body electorate through the candidates that make it to the last stretch?
Yeah, part of the one of the illusions I suspect the head of the Russian Election Commission was making was the fact that we do not have direct elections for the president of the United States. Instead, the popular vote in each of the 50 states is supposed to be reflected in what's called the Electoral College. That is, each of the 50 states appoints a certain number of electors. That, in theory at least, and usually in practice, I have to grant, reflects what the popular vote was in the state. But we have to keep in mind that arithmetically or hypothetically, one of the two candidates could get 49% of the vote in all 50 states and have no votes in the Electoral College. If his opponent got one more vote in each of those 50 states, so it's not proportional, and in that sense, it's not representative.
Mm. So, in whose interests is it to maintain that that state of affairs?
Yeah, I'll be real terse. Wall Street and the Pentagon.
Okay, so now you've written articles on the elections. I think in your most recent one, you commented on the foreign policy debate, I guess in quotation marks.
Yeah, inverted commas for sure, as I say in Canada. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to maybe get you to talk about that a little bit. In terms of what's actually expressed during a presidential debate, is this a measure of their actual positions, or is it a measure of what they want certain people to hear?
That's a valuable question, and it's some combination of the two, which is to say that there tends to be a difference between the demagogic mouthings of a candidate during an election and what he, we can use that exclusively male gender, of course, in the United States as well, another indication we're hardly a democratic system. We hardly have a democratic system. But when he gets into office in January, whether it's Obama or Romney, some of the blustering and the saber rattling and so forth may not materialize. Unfortunately, some of it may. And as your listeners are aware, one topic of debate throughout this campaign is which of the two candidates, should he be elected president on November 6th, is more likely to launch an act of military aggression against Syria, or worse yet, which is likely to start a war against Iran. And, both of them have, spoken in very bellicose terms vis-a-vis both the government in Syria and in Iran. And, it's something, again, that the American people are not polled on. Their opinions are not solicited. I don't believe there's anything like a majority of the American electorate that desires the government to perpetrate military aggression against Syria, Iran, or anyone else, but their opinions are not taken into account, of course. So that in terms of the second debate, I assume you're alluding to, or the third debate, rather, whichever it was, they all...
The one on the 22nd.
Yeah, they blur together in my mind. There's so much stuff and nonsense and, hot air. There were some minor differences, and there were minor differences in emphasis between the two candidates on the question of Russia, for example, where somebody in the Obama strategy team evidently saw a chink in the armor of Romney, as Romney had mentioned a few months ago that Russia was America's main geopolitical adversary in the world. And Obama seized on that and said, that Romney was incorrect, that it's not Russia but Al-Qaeda and so forth. But, these are electioneering tricks, and they don't necessarily reflect the position of either or both of the candidates. But what we do know is this, that both of them have the same messianic, megalomaniacal perspective, and they repeated it, ad nauseum. That the United States is, to quote current President Obama on the occasion of his receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, and I'm quoting him, the world's sole military superpower. They have, perspective that the United States is a model for the world, that anyone who doesn't emulate the American political system, and I've just described it to your listeners, is inherently at fault. They have a deficient system and needs to be changed by peaceful means or otherwise. And on the basic contention that the U.S. is not only a model for the world, but reserves the exclusive prerogative of dictating to the rest of the world how they should conduct their internal politics, neither candidate or the candidates didn't disagree, of course. So you start from that premise, and then you look at the particulars. Both of them celebrated the war against Libya last year, the 6.5-month bombing onslaught against a defenseless nation. The only point of contention between Obama and Romney was how much the United States should have done to protect its ambassador to Libya, who was killed in Benghazi, but not about the war, which now, as we know, has devolved into genocidal fighting in the city of Bani Walid and elsewhere in the country. So substantively, of course, there's no appreciable difference between the two candidates. They're both serving the same masters, which is the military-industrial complex in Wall Street.
Is it possible to maybe tease out a difference in approach in terms of the way you go about taking on that agenda?
Well, certainly, and in the language that is prevalent in the United States right now, There's an alleged difference between soft power and hard power, and the current U.S. Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has made much of the soft power theory, by which one should read subversion, color revolutions, you know, other regime change measures short of firing cruise missiles or dropping bombs on a country, but the result of which, or the intent of which, are the same, of course, which is remaking the world after America's image, or at least in its interest. So that, you know, there are fine points of distinction that keep well-paid political commentators in the New York Times and the Washington Post in business. But in terms of what it means for the world, or what it means for the average American, I have to insist that there's no substantial difference. Both, of course, still see the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as America's main military alliance for subjugating Europe politically and for use in you know, wars in Asia and Africa and Middle East elsewhere in the world. There's no difference on that score. They both support the further recruiting of former Soviet republics, now independent states, into NATO. They both believe in what is euphemistically called missile defense, which is to say son of Star Wars, or setting up a global interceptor missile system. They both believe that a military budget last year of $729 billion in the United States, which in constant dollars, Michael, is the highest since 1945, that's to say World War II levels, is not only permissible but praiseworthy. Incidentally, that works out to over $2,300 every man, woman, and child in the United States. On that score, they have no substantial difference again. So that if you're looking at foreign policy, it's more, I think, a matter of image or technique than it is of substance or purpose.
Mm. Well, I mean, I've just recall there's an investigative journalist, Robert Perry, wrote an article that appeared in the Global Research calling Romney a neocon Trojan horse. And you're referencing some of the individuals that back the Bush administration, and that he may be just putting on a moderate face to just appease the independents, and then might prosecute a much more aggressive kind of foreign policy. But do you see it that way, or does it make a difference in your mind?
You know, I don't, and I know I'm probably going to offend a lot of your listeners, but you know, I've heard the term neocon bandied about. Since George W. Bush was elected in the disputed and eminently unfair election of 2000, where he received 500,000 votes less than his opponent and nevertheless became president. But I believe that by focusing entirely on neocons, that we end up exonerating the system as a whole, as though to suggest that, the neocons are some sort of political anomaly, and that otherwise U.S. foreign policy is perfectly, humane and democratic and honest and so forth. It's not. And what you're suggesting about Romney, who knows? I mean, he only has his political credentials only extend to being governor of a comparatively small New England state, so he has no foreign policy record to run on. Obama does. And that includes, increasingly murderous drone missile attacks in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya. It includes, the war against Libya last year and so forth. So if you want to judge people strictly by the record, one is a war criminal in chief and the other is an aspiring one. And, American history, I don't want to get into, too arcane. I don't want to be too arcane here, but, there's a history of people talking tough and then acting a lot more restrained once in office, and there's the opposite, as you imply. But it's not a good prospect, regardless of which of the two gets into office.
Mm. So if this presidential election is, at best, an interesting media spectacle, it is seeming to dictate certain kinds of timelines in terms of how the military and Wall Street operate. Are you able to project, then, regardless of who the next president is, what we could expect from the United States, both domestically and foreign policy-wise, going into 2013?
More of the same. The Defense Department budget will actually be smaller next year, projected at least, than it was last year or this year, comparatively. There have been cuts, but these have been dictated by the economic crisis in the United States, rather than any newfound pacific sentiments amongst the ruling elite here. So what's called smart defense in NATO lingo, the idea that you get more bang for the buck, more deaths for the dollar, however one cares to define that. And there, I mean, there are differences about in regards to you know, individual missile weapon systems and, you know, procurement contracts and so forth, largely based on, you know, where the weapons are produced and, you know, which party the senators, the two senators in the respective state belongs to and so forth. So they'll tussle or argue about whether this attack helicopter or that should be ordered by the Pentagon, you know, based on the political clout of somebody in the Senate. But again, what I am certain will occur in January, regardless of who, you know, occupies the Oval Office in the White House, is we're going to see again global U.S. arrogance, threats, perhaps acting on those threats in terms of overt military aggression. There will be no substantial. You know, there are, again, I mean, I think, you know, domestically, there are core constituency groups within each of the two major parties that have issues of a lot of concern to themselves and maybe, you know, arguably to the general populace. And one party or another does represent one or another of those constituencies more thoroughly. And that's really the basis, you know, upon most people voting. Well, and I shouldn't say that. Most people vote according to party loyalty, and it's usually multi-generational. Almost everyone I know votes either Democrat or Republican because their father did and his father before that. You know, I should also point out, because of the curious nature of the Electoral College and the indirect voting for the president, that there have been articles estimating that as few as the election will hinge on the vote in as few as 61 to 72 counties in the United States, meaning whichever way they go, the election as a whole goes. So whatever the popular vote turns out to be aggregately, it's insignificant. It's irrelevant, because what will ultimately determine who gets elected president on November 6th is who gets one more vote than his opponent in as few as 61 counties in the country.
Rick Rozoff manages the organization Stop NATO International. He's an investigative journalist and is a frequent contributor to globalresearch.ca. Rick Rozoff, thank you very much for sharing your insights with us.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I wish I had something more optimistic to tell you, but truthfully, until we reshape the political system here in the United States, I won't. There will be nothing better.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Rick.
Thank you, Michael.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast on CKUW 95.9 FM and on participating campus community radio stations across the country. You can download our show from the website for the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. This week, we're focused on the 2012 U.S. presidential election campaign.
Media is an important outlet for informing American citizens about their options and for helping them set the proper policy priorities as they head for the ballot box on November 6th, or so the theory goes. There's been a saturation of media coverage of the presidential election campaign, but how well is the public served by the coverage they've seen? Peter Phillips is professor of sociology at the University of California at Sonoma. He's also co-author of a 2006 bestseller, Impeach the President, The Case Against Bush and Cheney. So thanks for joining us, Peter Phillips.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. It's California State University, not the University of California, but we're happy with that.
Okay, my apologies. So, Peter Phillips, maybe you've had some... you've observed the elections campaign so far, and I'm wondering if you could give a rundown of the top most censored stories of this election campaign. What are the issues that we should be addressing that we're not?
Well, certainly number one would be the wars, the ongoing wars in Afghanistan, the continued deaths in Iraq, drone attacks in Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, and other places around the world. And then operating special forces on the ground in over 100 countries. So, and the presidential assassinations. So we have both parties approving the fact that despite human rights and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and ideas of due process and belief in that in our country, that it is okay for a president to identify someone and then assassinate them. So these are very troubling issues that are not being brought forward and remain a very prejudicial extent that these are just bad people being killed or going to hurt Americans in some way, and it's simply not true.
What about in terms of domestic policy? Are you seeing certain issues that are being sort of pushed aside?
Well, certainly the issues of poverty. I mean, they both are trying to claim that unemployment is, they're going to increase more jobs. That may be, it may not be, doesn't matter really who gets in. What we're seeing is a continued decline of the working class in the United States. It's been ongoing for the last 30 years. Working people just can't make it as well anymore. Part of that is inflation. The cost of the essentials that people need to buy, energy and food, that's directly related to the bailouts to the banks and what's called quantitative easing. That's just the creation of money to circulate, thereby diminishing the value of the money that's already out there. So it's a tax on working people. When gas costs more or food costs more, you're paying an indirect tax to subsidize the central banks and the global economy and the dollar. We're desperately trying to keep the dollar as the number one currency in the world. That's not working very well, and it's clearly under threat. So when we talk about a domestic policy, we should be talking full employment, jobs for everyone, reduced military budget, and domestic spending that eliminates poverty in the country. We can certainly afford that. But that is not on the agenda. It's only on the agenda in, like, Jill Stein, the Green Party, and some of the other third-party candidates.
Mm. There seems to be an ongoing meme about the Obama, the socialist, and this idea that somehow, I mean, it's used principally by the Republicans, but has the... Have the candidates been appropriately challenged? Why does it seem like that meme is sticking?
The word socialist has become to mean anything that benefits a group of people, a policy. If it's aimed at the bottom 90% of the people in the country, we have socialist policies for the rich. We have tax subsidies and financial support for agriculture for various businesses in this country, but that's not called socialism. That's called, stimulate the economy or keep things going. But when we start talking about Social Security and welfare and benefits that keep people alive in the bottom half of the country, those become identified as socialism. And nothing could be further from the truth. That's just absolutely false. And it's a strong misuse of the term, because socialism, by definition, is democratic, where people get to make the decisions. And in our case, with this election, there really is no distinction between the Democrat and the Republican Party, other than a few minor domestic areas like abortion.
I've heard that when it comes to environmental issues, that this may be the first time when there's been virtually no mention of trying to resolve the crisis around the environment or other environmental issues for that matter. Why do you? Do you agree with that assessment? And why would that be the case?
Well, the crisis for the environment, certainly global warming, and the continued carbon expansion of particularly the United States, where the number one use of carbon and polluting the world's environment, we have to change. We're going to have to be sustained. It's going to happen inevitably within the lifetime of my students that will be forced to get out of cars, that will be forced to reduce our electrical use. Or else the environment is just going to completely collapse. It's quite severe. And the severity of that, the storms that we're seeing now in New England, the hurricanes and matching, you know, these are century events that are predicted to happen more frequently. So we're seeing extreme weather. It is related to global warming and increased levels of the seas. And that's going to be catastrophic for us in the long run. So having some plans for accelerated changes in our environmental footprint is absolutely necessary. And neither party, both are beholden to the energy companies and to a continued consolidation of wealth in the upper 1%.
Mm. Are there any areas where you think that each of the candidates, I mean, given stuff they said, where you felt like, say, what Romney might say or what Obama might say, that you wanted to stand up and say, hey, journalists, why aren't you asking them this? Are there any, you know, if you were in the press gallery, is there anything that you would want in particular that you would want to address to each of those candidates?
I certainly want to address the issues of a lost civil liberties for people living in the U.S. and worldwide. The protections under due process, habeas corpus, the rights of not being incarcerated, having a lawyer represent you, all of that has been undermined first in the Bush administration since 9/11 and now and expanded in the Obama administration. So I don't see any difference if Romney gets in or Obama stays in terms of the protection of civil liberties for people in the United States and around the world. We are becoming the repressive society, a police state, if not already made, if not and expanding and facing out in our daily lives. I was kind of shocked that, you know, the Giants won the World Series, of course. The billionaires that own the Giants are going to make more money. But everybody was excited. But Homeland Security became involved in uncovering fraudulent Giants jerseys that were being sold in the street. So this is a protection of business interests. This is not a protection of American citizens. And it just seemed outside of what they claim to be doing, and I was quite surprised by that the other day.
Now, we're based in Canada, so I was wondering if you might want to sort of throw out, any particular consequences to this election that might affect Canada. Maybe the Keystone XL pipeline. I know that Obama has expressed had expressed at least some opposition to it or has stalled it for a while.
He's not going to oppose it in the long run. I mean, it's almost like it's an inevitable. The goal for the energy companies is to control the global oil as long as they possibly can and make as much profit out of it. So developing tar stands and the terrible environmental impacts that has in Canada and central United States is a long-term strategy. As oil depletes in Saudi Arabia and other parts around the world, U.S. wants to continue to be on the dominant end of controlling global oil. That puts the U.S. in a stronger position vis-a-vis China, which is our principal economic rival today. And in the long term, of course, militarily, the Russians. So that becomes a primary agenda that neither a party is going to not address, and it clearly affects Canada in a major way.
Mm-hmm. What about trade deals? Is there any particularly different perspective there?
Capital can flow, workers can't. Repression of wages is an ongoing pressure because as unions are weakened and both governments continue to take on an agenda that favors the 1% over the rest of the world. And that 1% is the transnational corporate class. They're in corporations all over the world. And, you know, there's about 40 million people, adults, in that top 1%. And, then there's about 1,200 billionaires. And they're interlocked in networks of power that are transnational. They're not just Canada or the U.S. They're global. They're powered networks through NATO, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and they meet in places like Davos or where the Bilderberger groups meet, Trilateral Commission, to make plans to continue to allow capital concentration among the 1% worldwide at the expense of all the rest of us.
Well, Peter, is it, given what everything you've said, I mean, is there any point in casting a ballot in the upcoming election?
Well, Chris Hedges has been quite adamant about that. He says, yes, we have to continue to vote, but it doesn't really make a difference if you're just voting Republican and Democrat. So he says, you know, vote third party and then get out as quickly as you can back into the street demanding change. And, you know, pushing for organizing and grassroots social movements of non-cooperation and non-violent resistance.
Okay. And I was wondering if you see in the 2012 election, in terms of media coverage and, you know, the talking points throughout the election, is there anything that distinguishes it from previous elections? Has it gotten worse? Has it gotten better?
Corporate media today is managed news. It's top-down propaganda in almost every arena. So these are corporations in themselves who are interlocked with the top giants in the world, particularly linked to the central banks, pushing an agenda that says, you know, capitalism is going to save us, so we'll trickle down, we'll all get jobs, and it simply isn't true. So alternative independent media from the bottom up, is our agenda. Certainly at Project Censored, that's our agenda, and we're seeing that emerging all over the world. And it's a vital piece of any kind of social movement, of democratic socialism or democratic responses to the powerful. And that's the agenda. That's where we need to go.
Okay. Well, Peter Phillips, it's certainly been great talking to you, and we really appreciate your insights on this issue. So all the best in the coming days.
Okay, Michael, thanks for having me on.
And I've been speaking with Peter Phillips, a professor of sociology at California State University at Sonoma. Joining us to talk more about the elections is Julie Levesque. She is a researcher and journalist. She is a contributor to the Center for Research on Globalization website. And she recently posted an article that is entitled, Who Will Win the Election? The Republicrats. So to tell us a little bit more about that article and about some of the other interesting items on the Global Research website is Julie Levesque. So thank you for joining us, Julie.
Thanks for the invitation.
Okay, so when you talk about the Republicrats, essentially you're underlining the idea that they're really just one party in two sections kind of thing.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, there's not much difference between the Republicans and Democrats. It's actually, the packaging is different, but the content is the same. You know, they practically agree on major issues, on key issues. It's just in the way of doing things that there might be some differences. For example, there was an article about called Obamacare, which reflects, you know, the Republicrats.
Yeah, Obama and Romney.
Yeah, Obama and Romney. They're their stand on the health issues, and it was written by Paul Craig Roberts. And basically, what he says is that, you know, Obamacare, or Romneycare, it's two versions of the same thing, really. It's the goal is to convert healthcare into profits, and so yeah, on domestic policy, it's pretty much, you know, they're both backed by Wall Street, and in terms of foreign policy, I mean, both of them agree on the wars of aggression. It's just in the way of expressing their ideas and their goals that there is a difference. But basically, it's pretty much the same. You know, and the latest, in the last debate on foreign policy, it was really clear right from the beginning. I mean, both candidates talked about about Iran, how much of a threat Iran represents, how you know, they need to fight Al Qaeda, who attacked them on 9/11. They need to do something about Syria. Both of them agreed on those issues. You know, so I mean, there's not. Is there a difference between Republicans and Democrats? Not really.
Mm. Could it be along the lines of, in terms of when you assemble your international coalitions? I know that the Bush administration was somewhat notorious for driving their agenda sort of without much regard for what the rest of the world thought. And with Obama, he seems a little bit more diplomatic. Is it that kind of a difference? I mean, same agenda, but maybe different approaches?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think, you just said it, you know, it's a different approach,
mm-hmm.
but I think the goals are the same. Maybe the Republicans are a little bit more aggressive and the Democrats a little bit more diplomatic, but the goals are the same, you know, mm-hmm. about Syria, for example. Remember, in the debates, it was pretty clear, and they both said it, you know. Well, Obama said it, you know. Romney doesn't have any different ideas, because Romney was suggesting, suggesting that to replace Assad and have a new government in place, which is friendly to the U.S., and he said he wanted to make sure that the rebels, so-called rebels, are being armed to remove Assad. And he said textually, I'm going to read it to you. He said, we need to make sure that they have the arms they need to carry out the very important role, which is getting rid of Assad. And then Obama replied, well, you know, Governor Romney said exactly that, you know, he doesn't have any different ideas because we're doing exactly what should be done, you know, and that's exactly it, you know. Promote a moderate Syrian leadership, that's what he said. And a transition so that we get Assad out. So, I mean, it's exactly the same. And on the Iranian issue, the same as well, you know.
Hmm.
So.
Now, there are other candidates for president that have their own policy options. Are we seeing a little bit more diversity there?
Yeah, well, actually, we never get to hear the other candidates, and that's one of the reasons is because the Commission on Presidential Debates, which regulates the debates on national TV, it's a private corporation, and it's headed by former chairman of the Republican and the Democratic parties. And through the Commission on Presidential Debates, the two-party candidates can draft secret agreements and debate arrangements, and they can choose the moderators, the debate format, and even the participants. So basically all other candidates are excluded from those debates. It's always only the Republicans and the Democrats. And for example, you see in 2008, all the other candidates except the Republicans and the Democrats were against the bailout. So there was no debate on that. You know, the Republicans were, you know, it gave the impression that the bailout was inevitable and that it was in the public interest, when, in fact, you know, all of the candidates were against it. But the Americans didn't get to hear that point of view. So, of course, there are different ideas and platforms, but the Americans don't get to hear them.
Hmm.
You know, or for foreign policy, for example, you know, I'm sure there are other candidates who are, you know, against the wars.
Now, I understand there are there's another aspect. I mean, even if there were no significant differences between the two main contenders, that there's another there's prospects for fraud in these elections. Am I
yes,
right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because there's still, you know, there's still a competition, even if, you know, it's pretty much the same people who are backing the two parties. Actually, there was a few articles have been written about Bob Fitrakis and Jerry Bello on the fact that the Romneys well, actually, the title of the article was, "Does the Romney Family Now Own Your E-Votes?" The thing is that the Mitt Romney, his wife, his son, and his brother are major investors in an investment firm called HIG Capital. And they are through a closely held equity fund, which is called Sullimere. And HIG holds a majority share and 3 out of 5 board members in Hart InterCivic, which owns, in turn, the voting machines that will count the ballots in several states, including the state of Ohio. Now, if you remember, in 2004, it was in the state of Ohio that there was major fraud, including voting machines and softwares maintained by Triad, and they were all owned by Republican partisans.
Mm-hmm.
And
that would be the Diebold software?
Diebold and ES&S.
Mm-hmm.
They were all owned by Republican partisans, and what Petrakis and Harvey Wasserman wrote was that in 2004, the Secretary of State Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell was allowed to shift a 4% Kerry lead to a 2% Bush victory. So after midnight, there was like a shift of more than 300,000 votes, which is, you know, virtually impossible. Now, the man who was contracted to do that, to engineer that that shift, was Michael Connell, who was close to the Bush family as well. And that man has been subpoenaed to appear in court in a federal lawsuit on the 2004 election. And he mysteriously died in a plane crash in December 2008. There's a lot of questions on, you know, those, the fraud in 2004, and there was issues about the Romneys owning the e-votes this year.
Now, if a Democrat was, if the Democrats were cheated out of votes in that election, and if the evidence is compelling, why has it not been challenged by the Democrats?
Well, I think, you know, it hasn't been challenged because the same reasons we talked about earlier. You know, it's pretty much the same people. There is competition between the two parties, but there is, not a link, but they're walking hand in hand to avoid the other parties from taking power. So, it's... if John Kerry didn't speak, I mean, it speaks for itself that, you know, he was either told not to say anything, or, I'm sorry, I got confused there, my other phone rang.
Okay.
Could you start over?
Well, I was just wondering if there is a sufficient evidence that... as you said, the Democratic vote went from a 4% deficit mm-hmm. to a 2% lead. Why was it not challenged by the Democrats?
Well, there is no. I mean, it's a good example. I mean, I think we could go back to when Obama first came to office. You know, and. He didn't challenge any of the misdeeds of the Bush administration, you know, about torture. He said, oh, we're going to move forward. I think, you know, and in order to keep the two parties in power, they need to sometimes, you know, let go of the misbehaviors of the others.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the end, the ones who are funding the parties are the same people, so...
Yeah.
That's probably why it was not contested.
The Republicrats.
Yes.
Okay. Well, is there anything else from the Global Research website? I mean, there's been ongoing coverage of the U.S. election from this sort of alternative angle. Any other subjects of note that you think might warrant listeners' attention?
Yeah, well, actually, there's a huge file of articles and videos as well on the elections. On the 2012 elections and on the fraud, the election fraud in 2004. So, just visit our website and you will have all the articles and videos there.
Okay. Well, it's I think it's very welcome to see that sort of alternative perspective available. And I know that you've been active with the Center for Research on Globalization for some time now and have contributed quite a few articles on your own. So I want to thank you for sharing these insights with our audience.
And, well, thank you.
I hope you'll be available for more interviews in the coming weeks and months.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Julie.
You're welcome.
And that was journalist and researcher Julie Levesque, who is a contributor to the Center for Research on Globalization.
Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys and the rivers and the plains. Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all. From Colorado, Kansas, and the Carolinas too, Virginia and Alaska, from the old to the new, Texas and Ohio and the California shore, tell me who could ask for more. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom, glory shall rest on us all. Yet she's only as rich as the poorest of the poor, only as free as a padlocked prison door, only as strong as our love for this land, only as tall as we stand. For here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom, glory shall rest on us all. Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys and the rivers and the plains. Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. All her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Glory shall rest on us all, on us all.
That was Phil Oakes with Power and the Glory. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour with our special look at the 2012 U.S. presidential election campaign. The Global Research News Hour is broadcast every Thursday at 10 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM and on our partner stations across the country. You can download our podcasts from the Center for Research on Globalization's website at globalresearch.ca. I am host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.